Hello there. For this week's bonus content, we have the leftovers of our interview with Liam Adams, religion reporter for The Tennessean. Liam talks about some specific cases of abuse and misconduct the PCA has dealt with, his reporting on the Nashville Presbytery, the PCA's 2022 Domestic Abuse and Sexual Assault Report, also known as the DASA Report, the PCA's Standing Judicial Commission, which is the PCA's internal court, his approach on which stories are worth covering, how the PCA compares to other evangelical denominations in the larger cultural conversations around abuse, and other topics. This conversation has really nothing to do with the unsolved murder of Elizabeth McIntosh, and it's a pretty deep dive into some issues in the PCA that are going on today. But a large part of our audience has at least some connection to the PCA, so Liam's work should be of some interest there. Also, this is bonus content, so you get what you get. One technical note, Ruth's audio levels were a little overblown during the recording of this interview, so sorry about that. I cleaned it up as best I could. And with that, I bring you Liam Adams.
Hi, I'm Liam Adams, and I'm the religion reporter at the Tennessean. So I cover both the local faith community here in the greater Nashville region, and I also cover several large Protestant denominations that are based here or largely based here in Nashville, including the Southern Baptist Convention and the United Methodist Church.
Okay, so you talked about some church groups and denominations that you cover. What was your impression coming to Nashville of the PCA as a group of churches and denomination?
Yeah, I had little encounter with the PCA up until, I would say, last summer of 2023, when the PCA General, started with the PCA General Assembly, met in Memphis in June. And I had approached that from a sort of local coverage perspective, and that quickly turned into a larger national focus. What I didn't expect at the time was that the issues I was reporting on at the PCA General Assembly related to clergy misconduct and disciplinary measures would be playing out in my own local presbytery. And so I spent the fall and winter of 2023 last year really kind of digging into these wider issues around clergy misconduct in the PCA and seeing them play out locally. And so what I've tried to do is report the details of these local cases, but also tell these sort of more broadly relevant stories about how the PCA is responding to cases of clergy misconduct and how they are improving the disciplinary measures to hold these clergy accountable.
Yeah. So we're mostly talking about Nashville Presbytery now, right? With can you walk me through some recent stories that you've worked on?
Yeah. So we had two kind of major cases in the Nashville Presbytery in 2023 that really consumed a lot of my reporting throughout the year, which were cases of a pretty well-known prominent pastor, Scott Sauls, and another pastor named Ian Sears. And both faced discipline in 2023, both for very different reasons. And yet both of their cases were, there were similarities in how the Nashville Presbytery handled their discipline. And so as a result of that, I dug into some of those similarities. In fact, had written a story about what do the cases of Scott Sauls and Ian Sears say about larger issues with accountability in the PCA.
I mean, what have you learned like through the course of that? What are some things people are telling you about whether accountability is like appropriately handled, or like do people want things to be different? What are some of the different perspectives around that?
Yeah, I'm going to backtrack a little bit and actually sort of zoom out and look at how this issue is playing out across the denomination and then sort of what I saw in the Nashville Presbytery. So in 2022 was a real sort of turning point for the PCA because a report was presented. It's known as the Report of the Ad Interim Committee on Domestic Abuse and Sexual Assault. So this was a special committee that the PCA General Assembly in 2019 had commissioned. And this group had worked for years on developing a report and providing recommendations to the PCA General Assembly. And that committee, they just sort of commonly known as the DASA Committee, had presented its findings at the 2022 PCA General Assembly. And that report had included research on the sort of theological underpinnings of why the PCA should improve its system at handling clergy misconduct and where there are gaps and holes in its system addressing these issues of clergy misconduct. And so that has then led to a series of recommendations measures at subsequent PCA General Assemblies, which are known as overtures, to try and change that system. When I say the system, I'm referring really to two different channels in which the PCA can address clergy misconduct. The easiest way of describing it is case with process and case without process. Case with process generally refers to the church court system. It's think of it similar to our court system here. There's a trial, there's judges, there are witnesses, there's a defendant, there's a counsel for that defendant. And the report from the DASA committee had talked about some major issues with the church court system. And in addition, it had talked about this other channel that I referenced called case without process. And case without process is when a pastor essentially confesses to wrongdoing. They come forward and it expedites the process to disciplining those clergy.
Would that be like if a pastor doesn't contest the charges?
Correct. And the best way it was described to me, because I did a lot of reporting on this idea of case without process, because we saw that here in the Nashville Presbytery. And I also found that case without process is used far more commonly than the other option when dealing with clergy misconduct. And the way to sort of describe it is a pastor in the PCA described it to me as essentially the same as pleading guilty in our sort of civil and criminal, you know, or criminal court system here or civilian court system here is somebody pleading guilty. And that is beneficial for what the case without process protocol, if you will, is beneficial for the presbyteries that in which it's used because it saves them time and money. However, those cases are usually handled behind closed doors, and the what they kind of call quote unquote offended parties or the victims, those who have been subject to clergy abuse or misconduct, they have had little say in what those sort of final charges are that a minister confesses to. And so these are some of the problems that I saw here in the Nashville Presbytery and that the PCA largely is working on reforming. And I can talk a little more about what that reform looks like.
No, good overview. It's funny, people have tried to explain that to me multiple times and like I get it, but very succinctly done. Good work.
Thanks.
Scotland, Scottish Presbyterians have made a very complicated system. But to your point, it's interesting that this piece of the process, or the part without process, so to speak, when people plead guilty, what that also means, right, is that the case what is made private. And so even if somebody pleads guilty, quote unquote, there's not necessarily any way for a layperson to understand what happened. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I'll kind of go, I'll share a little more detail about how that works. Again, it's called case without process, or the way people will refer to it more commonly in the PCA is 38.1. It refers to the PCA Book of Church Order, section 38-1. And what happens in that process is, and it can happen at different stages in which a victim comes forward with an allegation about clergy abuse, for example. And ultimately, when 38.1 is used, what that usually results in is an executive session among the presbyters. The presbyters are sort of the voting elders of any given presbytery. And in a presbytery meeting, they will discuss the charges that that clergy confessed to. And then they will make a determination about how to censure that minister. So you have one major problem here, which is that these charges are discussed in executive session if 38.1 is used. And so members of the public, including those who raise the initial allegation of wrongdoing, as well as, take for example, the members of a church, if a pastor was accused of wrongdoing or confessed to wrongdoing in 38.1, they wouldn't know what those charges are. So you have this sort of behind closed doors issue, but then there's another issue in this case without process protocol, which is that there have been several ministers who have then appealed the censure. So a censure is a disciplinary judgment that a presbytery gives a minister. And that minister will appeal that censure, arguing that the presbytery did not follow the right protocol outlined in the Book of Church Order, and that thus their censure should be overturned. And the minister, when they appeal it, they're appealing it to the PCA Standing Judicial Commission, which is the denomination's highest court. And I wrote a whole story about 38.1 and the issues that go along with it. And I found that since 2008, this PCA Standing Judicial Commission has ruled against presbyteries in 5 out of 7 cases in which the presbyteries use 38.1 to handle a minister's discipline. So it's actually pretty common in the cases that have happened since 2008 for a censure to be overturned on procedural grounds.
So you're saying in 5 out of 7 cases that you looked at, the presbytery agreed that the minister did something wrong, and the Standing Judicial Commission overturned that. And then what happens to a minister after that?
Well, their censure is reversed. Now, technically, that minister can go back into the PCA. That doesn't always happen, especially if, you know, some of these cases may have been more public and, you know, perhaps their reputation has been kind of harmed throughout this process, because there is some public nature of these SJC appeals. But you also have cases where the SJC overturned a minister's censure on grounds that a presbytery did not follow 38.1 properly. And then that minister went back into ministry in another denomination. And they're technically leaving the PCA without any disciplinary charges on their record. One of the things about the DASA report is that it did not look at sort of the number of cases of alleged clergy misconduct. It was not a statistical compilation of this issue throughout the denomination, which is something that we saw, for example, in a similar denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, where you had a 2019 investigative series by a newspaper, and then you had a third-party report a few years later showing how widespread, or at least a sample of how widespread, the abuses in the SBC and how denominational leaders at the national level mishandled or did not respond to those cases of abuse properly. We have not gotten that kind of census, if you will, within the PCA. But in my conversation with victims advocates, they're saying that's what we exactly need. They're saying that the DAS report was really important for building a foundation for a conversation in the PCA around reform and accountability and disciplining clergy. But the issue is still, there are a lot of people in the PCA that think this is not happening, or that this is not a widespread issue in the denomination. And from all the victim advocates that I'm speaking to, they're saying, yes, it is.
And just to make sure we're clear, what is the this that you're thinking of when you say that?
There's one, an issue of clergy misconduct and clergy abuse, both sexual abuse, domestic abuse, spiritual abuse, or abuse of power, and then just an issue with holding ministers accountable, or that the systems that exist, which is really grounded in the presbyteries, that's the whole name of the denomination and the whole system that it's built around, that the presbyteries, it's kind of a patchwork of certain presbyteries taking a lot of action, or taking, being proactive in implementing changes to holding ministers accountable, and that there are other presbyteries that kind of operate like an old boys club.
And you're saying that victims advocates you talk to are saying that all of those issues are present in the PCA. Some have been publicized through reporting or otherwise, but maybe there's a lot still that could be uncovered.
Yeah, that there are a lot more cases than we know of. And in fact, there are only a few cases that have really kind of come to the forefront. Some of those have to do with abuse, or abuse allegations, but not all. I mean, one of the cases that has kind of come to the consciousness, the sort of forefront in the PCA, is that of Dan Heron, who's a pastor up in Indiana. And the PCA's highest court, or the SJC, the Standing Judicial Commission, investigated allegations of sexual harassment against Dan Heron. And the SJC ruled in April of 2023 and didn't find him guilty. And so that case has raised some awareness in the PCA around allegations of sexual harassment against ministers. But you have a lot of other cases that are dealing with lesser known pastors. And so a good example of that is the one that I saw here in the Nashville Presbytery. His name is Ian Sears. He was a former pastor of the Church of Grace Village, which is a small church here in Nashville. And there was sort of a report of sexual misconduct raised against Ian Sears in February of 2023. And that led to a disciplinary process in which Ian Sears was censured with deposition, which means he's deposed from office. He's barred from ministry within the PCA. Ian Sears went through this protocol of case without process. And as a result of it, or in toward the end of it, he appealed this censure of deposition with the Standing Judicial Commission. And so we are waiting currently on what the SJC will decide on whether the Nashville Presbytery followed protocol in using this case without process, BCO 38-1. So his censure could be overturned. We don't know at this moment. But there are a lot, what I've been told is the case of Ian Sears, and I reported actually there was a second woman that came forward and raised allegations of sexual misconduct in a story that we reported. So this was not formally reported to the presbytery. This was a case that we reported. So this would be two separate women who have raised allegations of sexual misconduct against Ian Sears. And again, he's not as well known as a pastor. And I don't know the effect that my reporting's had PCA wide, but he's a good example of people who might fly under the radar a little bit. And, you know, there are a lot of those. It's a pretty big denomination. It's not as big as the SBC, but it's pretty big. And so you take those same statistics and you apply them to this denomination, you have a widespread problem of clergy misconduct.
So one of the interesting things about that case, right, is you reported about a more recent allegation, and then, correct me if I'm wrong in the order of how the stories were published, but then you published a story about an earlier allegation, and the two women didn't know about each other. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until your reporting. Walk me through a little bit what it felt like to have two sources telling you they had concerns about the same person, and then realizing that those cases might be connected but weren't officially connected in the record.
Yeah. So I'll give a little bit of an overview of chronologically what happened in the case of Ian Sears, which is that there was a case, an incident in which Ian was the pastor of this woman named Tracy Wells. And there was a pattern of behavior by Ian Sears toward Tracy Wells, in which, as it's described in my story, behavior of sexual misconduct. So that included kissing her head, rubbing her feet, and an overall sort of pattern of behavior to what Tracy's ultimately realized is grooming. And that happened in the early 2000s, and in 2004, it resulted in Ian Sears facing discipline of 6 months of suspension. And he returned back from that suspension and continued to pastor the Church of Grace Village. Well, then in about a decade later, there was another case of alleged sexual misconduct with another woman in his congregation. And the allegations of that case were initially raised to the Nashville Presbytery in 2020. And that was ultimately brought to a subcommittee of the Nashville Presbytery that ultimately decided not to pursue discipline against Ian Sears. That same woman, the second woman who raised allegations, then raised those allegations, reported Ian again in February of 2023, which led to the most recent process, that disciplinary process against Ian Sears, that led to his the censure of deposition, which he's now appealing. And so what you had in the case of Ian Sears was essentially this pattern of alleged sexual misconduct, returning to ministry, that misconduct being reported, and no action result, disciplinary judgment resulting, and then ultimately disciplinary judgment resulting. So the Nashville Presbytery has actually commissioned a special committee to review its handling of the 2020 report against Ian to see what went wrong. But definitely was a sort of case study in a pattern of behavior that went on longer than it should have.
Yeah. Well, and it also seems like a pattern of behavior where, I mean, did you ever find out if the first allegation, if that was kept on file, essentially, or was it just pushed away? And then by the time somebody found out about the later allegation, like, did they have to start from scratch, or did somebody put their hand up and say, oh, we've had something similar?
Yeah. So the 2004 case in which Ian Sears faced discipline, and that 6 month suspension for his behavior toward Tracy Wells, there is a record of it in the Presbytery minutes, which I have copies of. And there are people who were in the Presbytery at that point and are still there today. And I interviewed some of them, and their attitude was, well, one of the pastors who I interviewed, who's kind of involved in some of this case, was that, you know, Ian Sears was repentant for his behavior. At that time, they saw it was many of the members of this Nashville Presbytery subcommittee that handled it saw it as a sort of, it was mutual behavior from both Tracy Wells and Ian Sears. 20 years later, Tracy Wells and I've talked, and she's come to a much different understanding of what happened, which that it was not consensual, that it was him, that was Ian Sears grooming her. Ian Sears, again, I want to note, he has denied allegations that this was grooming, that this was misconduct. But the attitude of why Ian Sears was not only allowed to continue in ministry, but also in take up sort of leadership positions in the Nashville Presbytery, was because he had dealt with that previous incident, that previous discipline, and was repentant. And so when I say leadership position, he was actually eventually became chair of this presbytery subcommittee that handles clergy misconduct. And so you kind of have a case of not just only reports against him and him continuing in ministry, but also him overseeing sort of ministerial discipline, if you will.
In parts of the process, right.
In parts of the process.
Yeah, thank you for noting his response to all of this, too. We'll definitely note that as well. Talk to me about how, as a reporter, so you're dealing with all kinds of news about churches, right? Could be positive news, could be negative news, could be financial, could be a crime, could be policy, could be process. But you also brought up the word of spiritual abuse, and that being a topic that churches are thinking about, dealing with, having processes for or not. And that's always struck me as a hard thing to wrap your head around as a reporter, right? Because we're mostly talking about X happened and then Y happened. It's helpful when there are concrete events. It's hard when you get into the areas of, well, this thing made me feel unsafe, or this thing made me feel uncomfortable. And that strikes me as possibly even more difficult when religion is at play and we're talking about an even higher metaphysical realm. How do you sort through when somebody says, hey, I think I have a case where a pastor acted unprofessionally and abused his authority, but it's not a crime? How do you work through what rises to the level of a story, and how do you kind of approach that perspective?
Yeah. So I'll say first that anytime an alleged abuse victim or survivor comes to me, I take that story seriously and aspire to do that sympathetically and with care. A lot of the stories that I'm reporting are those that are about how the system responded. And there are also plenty of those as well. I think when I'm reporting on it depends on the denomination, because when I'm reporting on the SBC, there's been a lot of really sort of formational, foundational reporting on how the SBC has not handled these cases well. When I'm reporting on the PCA, there's a lot that needs to still be reported on this issue in the denomination and how the denomination is or isn't responding effectively. And so when I reported on the cases of Ian Sears, as well as Scott Sauls, but Scott Sauls is a very different case in sort of why he faced discipline, my approach has been to just give a very basic understanding of what the issues are and how the PCA system works. The PCA system is so complicated that the members of this ad interim committee at the PCA acknowledged that. They said, we even have trouble navigating this extremely complicated system of presbyteries and the hierarchy of how that all operates. And so when I was reporting on the cases of Ian Sears and Scott Sauls, I was explaining to readers, what is the Nashville Presbytery Shepherding Committee that handles ministerial oversight? What is case without process? I think in the PCA, we're going to get to the point where we can talk about it in the way that we do in the SBC. The conversation is so I mean, people think that the SBC has so far to go with reform, and that's true, but the conversation, this sort of lexicon, is so evolved at this point, because we've been talking about it for over 4 years, really sort of comprehensively, and the PCA isn't at that point yet. The PCA, the ad interim committee report in 2022 in the PCA really sort of jump-started that conversation, but in terms of the nuance of how abuse operates and how the system needs to improve, there's a lot that we still have to learn in the PCA. And so my reporting in 2023 on the National Presbytery, the PCA General Assembly, how it's dealing with clergy misconduct and abuse is at a very sort of base level to explain to people, this is how the system works. And this is one example of where it worked in a way in that benefited somebody who was accused of misconduct. We're not at the point in the PCA where we're ready to have these very evolved, high-level conversations about system-wide reform.
Great answer. Thanks. And one related question too. So one thing we're constantly toggling back and forth with this series is the PCA is a very small group of churches, as you said, right? How widespread do the issues and how widespread do the conversations seem to be compared to the other Christian denominations that you're reporting on? Do you get the sense that like this problem is particularly problematic or dangerous within the PCA, or is it more just to your point of different parts of American Christianity are at different phases of addressing it and talking about it?
Yeah, I don't think that any faith group, large faith groups, are exempt from this. I think what we are seeing, the PCA is a really good example of the same issues, and they allude a lot to the issues of abuse in the SBC, because I think we're seeing this larger pattern, this larger phenomenon of abuse allegations being raised in conservative evangelical, specifically complementarian spaces. And complementarian refers to a conservative evangelical view. It's primarily held by evangelicals around the role of men and women, and that men and women have certain assigned roles. And that usually includes that men are the head of the household and of the church. And the PCA is also dealing with this issue around basically women in leadership. There has been an effort to women cannot be appointed or ordained as elders in the PCA. And so there's been an effort to appoint women deaconesses in the PCA, and there's been a lot of pushback to that. And so I think we're seeing, not just in the SBC, but in the PCA, as well as another conservative denomination, the ACNA, the Anglican Church in North America, these larger sort of confronting questions around clergy misconduct and clergy abuse specifically. And I think, you know, as a result of that, we're seeing these sort of larger, broader and deeper analysis of what within those systems is not only lending to the abuse, but lending to existing systems' inadequacy at dealing with it. And I think you're seeing that in some of the, basically a deeper conversation around the theology, such as theology around complementarianism, but also the theology of the system of governance. And so in the PCA, the system of governance is different than it is in the SBC, but both the polity, that's what they call it, the sort of system of governance, the polity is just as big as part of a conversation around abuse reform as it is, we're talking about the sort of theology of complementarianism. And it's also the sort of one of the primary drivers of the opposition, because people say, oh, we can't change this because this would disrupt our system of governance. And those who are proponents of reform and accountability, both those who are within and without the denomination, are saying, no, we need to change this. This is, we've gone too long with letting the system exist as it does.
Because changing the process changes the power structure, and different people win and lose on that.
And I think that I want to be very clear that I'm not advocating for these denominations that change their theology around complementarianism. That's not my place to say, but there are those within these denominations that are saying, like, regardless of what we believe around complementarianism, we have this issue of abuse and we need to do something to deal with it.
Right. Well, I think if you read the DASA report too, you'll see that nobody's questioning the overall theology of their religion. People are saying, if we have this theology, we need a better process to actually reflect it and get justice to everyone who wants it. How do you balance letting somebody be innocent until proven guilty, which is super important in the world and also in the church, and not slandering people, but also raising red flags when you have them and saying, if somebody did something questionable once, how do I know if he hasn't done something questionable again? So I'm not really asking a question for the project, but I wondered if that had ever come up in your reporting on this case and if there's anything more you could share about it.
Yeah, so when reporting on the case of Ian Sears, take for example, or even Scott Sauls, which is a very, very different case. There wasn't any allegations of sexual misconduct. For me as a journalist, what's really critical is sort of getting this overabundance of evidence and information about specific incidents, but also a pattern of behavior. And so we go through a pretty rigorous process in terms of determining when we've reached that point of the amount of information that is worth reporting. In the sake of the PCA, what I think is really important to note is, and maybe this is relevant for the podcast, in the PCA, there is this increasing just sort of emphasis on how you report cases, how a church goes about reporting a case to the police when the police need to get involved, to law enforcement, and also to involve third parties. And this is not a super common practice right now. And this is something that the DASA committee had recommended, the ad interim committee had recommended in its report, to involve third parties much more regularly. And I can actually, I'll just read out those recommendations. The DASA committee had recommended that competent third parties be engaged by presbyteries, churches, and other PCA ministries when allegations of abuse arise, and that presbyteries, churches, and other PCA ministries share information regarding helpful pastoral, sessional, and third-party resources, and regularly set aside funds for engaging those that can provide competent assistance and, if necessary, conduct investigation of alleged abuse. So what you might have churches that are reporting to the police, but we're seeing in the PCA, the SBC, and other denominations, there needs to be an even larger emphasis on reporting to law enforcement immediately. And then to engage third parties. And that's not happening nearly. We're just seeing a few churches across the country throughout different evangelical denominations engaging third parties more regularly to sort of guide both the way that the church handles the allegations, investigates it, communicates it to the congregation and to the public. And in the case of the PCA, you know, I reported a lot last year on how this case without process, this 38-1 protocol was used. And the DASA committee recommends that even in cases, these kinds of instances where case without process is used, that third parties be engaged. That basically, again, this goes back to this idea of, like, we can handle it ourselves. And the DASA report saying, no, you can't, and you need to get somebody else involved to help guide these conversations.
Well, and those are cases too where we're not even talking about an internal dispute. We're talking about a criminal claim. And I believe I saw, I was just looking, I don't think it's been filed yet. I've heard somebody talk about filing an overture to make sure that if a session finds out about illegal contact of someone on staff, they have to report it to the police, which might be internal policy for the church, but isn't necessarily required by the denomination. So I'm interested to see how that goes.
And I want to say, you know, I mentioned earlier about this year's PCA General Assembly in terms of overtures that the General Assembly rejected that really stem from these proposals for reform and accountability. But there are other instances in which overtures have gone through that do stem from these recommendations for reform. And so, for example, that despite the rejection of overtures on allowing atheists to testify, the 2022 PCA General Assembly ratified a different overture removing hurdles for abuse victims to testify in a church court case. And that overture had received initial approval at the 2021 General Assembly. So again, there's already been one reform that was ratified by the 2022 PCA General Assembly on the side of church on case with process. And then on the other side of case without process, the PCA is in the process of ratifying an amendment to Section 38.1 or case without process, allowing quote unquote offended parties, such as victims of abuse, to review and comment on the statement of facts used in a minister's confession and in a presbytery's disciplinary judgment. And so that likely will be ratified at this year's PCA General Assembly in 2024. So they've already been reformed in both channels, case with process, case without process, and there are future ones expected because, again, those that were rejected last year, some of those were on more technical grounds. And so I want to be careful about giving the impression that the PCA General Assembly or the PCA is like overall and outright opposed to reform, but that there might be an openness and it's just a matter of kind of getting over some of these other reluctances around sort of how it would affect the governance structure or some of these larger theological ideas.
I guess one more question that occurs to me is, you know, without advocating for any particular policy solution, we're not advocating for any particular policy solution either, but what is the risk of not doing anything? You know, you could say that the current system works okay for most people in these churches. What's the risk of just, or what are some of the downsides people tell you of just continuing on as you are now, or churches continuing on as they are now, and just, well, you know, we think we catch most of the bad actors. Let's keep going.
Well, I think that the idea, again, this idea of like, this is not a problem we're dealing with is like inaccurate. People just may not be aware of issues happening perhaps in their own church, perhaps in their own presbytery or in other presbyteries. But the more that you sit on this, well, first, the worst it looks for you. And that has a material consequence. The more your denomination or church, it doesn't look good publicly, the less people are going to go to those churches, less people are going to trust those churches, or people who are members, congregants of those churches, the less trusting they have in the institution and they leave. So it has a sort of material, almost economic consequence. And I hear that a lot, both within the SBC, but other denominations, like, we need to deal with this because this is affecting our essentially public image. But the other thing I hear, and I think you see a lot of this language, it depends on how much these denominations are taking it to heart, but is it's hypocritical to their witness. to act according to their beliefs, their understanding of scripture, and how that informs the way that they care for people, you know, the vulnerable. And the less they deal with these things shows the less they mean it, essentially, the things that they claim to believe.